These materials are for your personal, non-commercial use only and may not be reproduced in any way or form without the prior written permission of Lorman Business Center. The information included in this audio recording is designed to provide general information on the seminar topic presented. It is sold with the understanding that Lorman Business Center is not engaged in rendering any legal or professional services, and this audio recording should not be used in place of legal or other professional advice from a licensed professional. Lorman Business Center is not responsible for the content of the information provided herein and makes no warranty whatsoever as to its accuracy or reliability. If you require legal or other professional advice, you should retain the services of a licensed professional.
Hello, we here at Lorman Education want to thank you for your purchase. Did you know that instead of purchasing products one at a time, we offer unlimited training for an entire year with our Lorman All Access Pass? That's right, a product that provides you with unlimited Lorman training for a simple and convenient way to learn on your own time, all for only $699. Contact an All Access Pass specialist today to discuss this amazing training opportunity at 877-296-2169. We look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy your course.
Hello and welcome to today's live webinar entitled Estate Freeze Due Diligence. At this time, I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Mr. John McManus. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, folks. For those of you who are on East Coast time, and good morning for those on the West Coast. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you. Today's topic is estate freeze due diligence. In respect to what is an estate freeze and how we're focusing on due diligence, it's really the notion of what areas of opportunity do you have to freeze estates, and what is an estate freeze, why is it relevant, and for whom it would be appropriate to be undertaking these plans. Since this is a continuing ed topic, it's important to emphasize that we believe these are ideas that your clients indeed should be hearing about, not just so that you're relevant and you are up to date on these relevant topics, but that you're presenting them to your clients, both for the purpose of adding value by letting them see the ideas you have, but equally presenting them with opportunities that could benefit you financially and the client as well. In many respects, there are many winners when you undertake these strategies. First, of course, the client, and then those who are the professionals that are helping. So as we move over page 2, slide 2, the strategies, what is an estate freeze, strategies of to transferring appreciating assets to the next generation and therefore freeze the value of the taxable estate. If we haven't this morning, as we are most days, on conversations with our clients, it's all about the celebration of what assets we have moved off their balance sheet over the years and the estate tax savings that we're getting on those assets. Typically, the assets are going into an asset protection trust, so in addition to the estate tax savings, there is an asset protection component as well. But you'll often hear a word in the sophisticated estate planning circles, which is gaining alpha on your estate tax planning. And more today than ever, the higher end clients are looking for alpha or yield in their investments in every aspect of their life, but are seeing lots of sectors flatline, and because of the flatlining, they're looking to chase yield in tax planning. And what can they do to minimize taxes, estate taxes, over the course of their lifetime, which in the end gives them a greater yield on their current investments. So estate freeze is to move assets over and therefore freeze the value of the taxable estate that remains in the estate. So goals of the estate freeze, we're on to slide 3, decrease the future value of the taxable estate, shift future appreciation to beneficiaries, take advantage of valuation discounts which may be limited in the future, and provide a stream of income for the donor of the asset. So number one and two we've discussed. Number three is to take advantage of valuation discounts. So a simple example is if you owned a piece of real estate and for some reason the market was weak and it was an apartment building and you took advantage of the weakness in the market and transferred that apartment building, which was otherwise worth, in for easy math, $10 million, but now you could get an appraisal for $8 million. Well, in the end, you knew that was a small blip in time, and for purposes of the transfer, the gift was $8 million, and you and your spouse used your combined $11 million of exemptions. The $8 million versus $10 means that you've moved an asset that's really worth $10 off your balance sheet that would have been taxed like $10 when you passed away, but in fact, you moved it out at $8 million, and that $2 million delta, that gap, is where the alpha in estate planning comes in. So now you are at a $2 million savings or a $500,000 times two for husband and wife, $1 million estate tax savings when you impute the total value. The last piece on estate freeze is what can I do to get an asset off my balance sheet but still enjoy the income stream? So again, using the example of an apartment building, if you were to sell that apartment building to your child at $8 million versus the $10 million during the weakness in the market, your child or children or a trust for your child or children will have to pay that asset back. They may get it completed before you pass away or may not, but what they would do is use the income from the apartments in that apartment building to pay you back. So yes, you've moved the asset. Yes, you sold it to a trust to protect your children. Yes, you did it in the form of a discount, so you saved estate taxes right off the bat. But in the end here, you're still enjoying the income stream. What you often will hear is, so goes the asset, so goes the income. But here, the income is used by your children's trust to pay you back. So you have moved the asset off, but you're still enjoying the income from that asset for many years to come. We're on to slide four. So here are four topics that we're going to discuss today. Grantor retained annuity trust, which is a strategy where you would not necessarily use real estate, but you would use a portfolio of $1, $3, $5, $10, $20, $50 million of assets that you would, in effect, loan to trust for your children. Number two is an installment sale to a defective trust, which is a strategy where you would sell assets to your trust for the benefit of your children, and but that your children would owe you a payment back as part of the financing, and you would then preserve an income stream for yourself. Number three is a partnership free strategy where you create a partnership and you preserve certain preferred interests for yourself, and then you have common interests for your children, which also will enable you to have an income stream for yourself, but be able to discount the value of their common interests versus yours, reducing the value of the gift either at the time of death or at the time you create the partnership freeze, depending on which strategy you want. And then, of course, annual gifting. What I like to say about the annual gifting, particularly for the ultra wealthy, is that it's like throwing a deck chair off the Queen Mary. It is not necessarily significant, but if you stand on the side of the Queen Mary and people keep handing you deck chairs and you keep throwing them off, sooner or later you'll clear the deck, maybe not in your lifetime, but the $14,000 annual gift can be given to anyone. And we recommend that those gifts be done at the beginning of the year so that the difference between your child or your loved one or a trust for your family members getting $14,000 in January 1 versus $14,000 on December 31st is that on January 1, they get $14,000 plus 3, 5, 7% appreciation on that number. So they're getting a greater number. And if you did a schematic of that, you'd see that the compounding is significantly higher if you make the gifts at the beginning of each year. It's now the end of the year. Does that mean you should wait? Absolutely not. It means you should get a gift in now, take advantage of this year, because it is a privilege that evaporates on December 31st, and so get that gift done, and then immediately, should you have the liquidity to do so, enlist in making the gift again on January 1 and keep that in place for the years going forward. Those will be the four topics we'll discuss today. So, a grantor retains annuity trust, also called the GRAT. One of the most prolific deployers of this trust were the attorneys that represented the Walton family for Walmart, and $1 billion of assets over the years by taking assets like the apartment building, but here it was stock in Walmart, and moving it by loaning that stock to children and grandchildren, and always knowing that the original principal was due back to you, plus a little bit of interest. But the explosion of growth on the Walton Trust through Walmart allowed for all the growth to take place off of Grandpa Walton's balance sheet, and all the growth to take place in the children's name. The children had to pay back the original value of the stock plus some interest, but in the end here it was a tax-free transfer, and once in a while it's always fun to look at where Forbes lists the top 400, and historically you could count on their three children being in the top 10 of net worth in the U.S., and I submit to you they're on that list because of tremendously effective use of GRATs, so that when Grandpa Walton died, they did not pay the 50% tax. The assets had already long moved out of his estate and had avoided estate tax and had avoided gift tax. So GRATs on the most extreme valuations, highest levels, they are the most effective. It is the area that President Obama knew that the ultra-wealthy take greatest advantage of it, but it doesn't have to be the ultra-wealthy. It can be a client that is just over the exemption amount, maybe, or they're approaching the exemption amount of just under $5.5 million, and they're saying, I've got more than enough for myself, and so at least let the growth go to our children or loved ones. But President Obama saw that strategy and said it is reserved for the top 1%, and sought to either outlaw it in total, or he came up with a strategy which said that GRATs would have to last at least a certain period of time, and that a portion of the GRAT would be taxed, to try to discourage people from doing it. Why are we bringing up President Obama? Because while President Trump has focused on trying to give significant tax relief, we understand full well that President Trump is only as effective as the time that he's in office with the people who would support him and back him up. So I finish by saying that today, like some other, many other areas, the GRAT is alive and well, but be mindful that when the next president comes in, and already we're seeing on panels people saying, why would we want to give tax relief to anybody like the Hunt brothers when they're billionaires, when more than 95% of the population right now is already under estate exemptions. And so looking for more tax relief from the next president after President Trump could very well be a pipe dream. Reducing the exemptions, which is what Hillary Clinton and the Bernie Sanders combined campaign was, which was from 5.5 million, they wanted it to go to 3.5. is always a possibility after President Trump leaves. And also, just by example, the new governor elected in New Jersey, after recently eliminating estate tax in New Jersey, has now pledged to reinstate the estate tax and not to bring the exemption up to where it is in New York and other states, but an exemption of only $2 million. So the idea of estate tax being eliminated and coming back is not only a possibility. It has happened multiple times over the course of U.S. history. And disproportionately in the 20th century, it has almost been here uniformly, save for a few unique periods like 2012, which was more of an anomaly and a legislative issue versus an intention of the parties. So doing grats for people who are at $4 and $5 million, that would be the starting point. But the more wealth that you have and the more that you put into a strategy for your clients and recommending, the more effective in pure dollars. Of course, the simple answer is if you do a $10 million grat and it grows by 10% over the term of the grat, there's $1 million less a little bit of interest you have to pay on the loan. So you may net just a little under $1 million. The same example for $5 million. A 10% return would be $500,000. But on a $50 million estate, a 10% return is $5 million that avoids tax. We think each of them plays a very important role in estate planning, whether it's a $5 million client, the $50 million client, the $500 million client, and so on. So, how does the strategy work? First, the donor transfers the property into an irrevocable trust and retains the right to receive an annual payment for a fixed period of years. And with that, the payments back include an imputed rate of interest. And that rate right now is FAR, which is under 2%, depending on how long the grat goes. Again, if the assets outperform the interest rate, any growth of the assets passes to the beneficiary's gift and estate tax-free, just like the apartment building, just like the portfolio for the Waltons. The growth is enjoyed by a trust of the beneficiary. Only a minimum gift is occurred when making the transfer to the grat, so very little lifetime gift exemption and estate tax exemption is used. A just tiny modest piece for retained interest that the IRS impute on the grat. We're on page 6 of 42. So Ben transfers $5 million into a grat with a fixed term of years. An annual payment of $539,300 is owed back every year for the five-year period based on the 75-20 rate of 1.4%. If the rate of growth is equivalent to 75-20, there will be no remaining property to go to the beneficiaries. Again, the whole idea here is that the portfolio has to outperform the rate of interest that's imputed. However, if the rate of growth is higher than 1.4%, for example, 3%, then over the course of 10 years, the remainder that will be available in trust for the children in the excess will pass. And here, under this example, it's $675,000. Should the grantor and the Generation 1 grandparents employ this grant, they'll pass $675,000 free. But what happens if they didn't? Well, presume that they're in the 50% tax rate. $675,000 is a little over $300,000 in estate tax that they would have to otherwise pay by failing to do this number, right? So $337,000 plus or minus is your number, right? All right, we're on to advantages. So we've shown little exemption is used, appreciation is out of the estate. Even if the assets do not perform well, the worst that happens is that the grantor loses out on legal administrative fees involved and setting up the grat. It is a technique that is statutorily permitted, so that the good news on this is that we're not looking for a private letter ruling or a strategy that some financial advisors have come up with without having any backup for it. employing the GRAT is right in the code for clients to use. What does it cost? We'll move on to slide 7, but as we do that, what does it cost to create the GRAT? So it depends on the markets around the country and the understanding of the attorneys that are doing the work typically. But you can expect that to set up the first GRAT and to get the structure in place and to have a relationship with the financial advisor who is going to move the assets into the GRAT, and then be very clear with the financial advisor and the client as to when the annuity payment has to come back every year. It is critical to know that the annuity payment must be made on time each year. There is a grace period, but the failure to do that blows the GRAT. So more than anything, an alarm has to go off on your watch, in your financial advisor's watch, and certainly on any other family members, including your attorney's watch as well. But to create that structure, the range on doing that is somewhere in I think the least expensive markets, $2,500 to $3,500. We have seen anywhere from $4,500 to $10,000 to get the first GRAT in place. We're going to talk a little bit about rolling GRATs, or taking the annuity payment and doing the GRAT again for the next round, and those GRATs should be less expensive because the structure is in place, the calendar event is before them, and can be a little bit less. But in the end, the lawyer is still providing and guaranteeing that the structure works under that new document. So the likelihood that they'll be giving away the legal services for the subsequent GRATs is low. But still, imagine that on the low end, $2,000 to $2,500 to $3,000 to $4,500 to $5,000 for subsequent GRATs after the structure is put together. So, disadvantages depends on the market. We've already stated that you've got to outperform the 75-20 rate. Number two, if the grantor dies during the term, all the trust assets are clawed back into the estate. This is a very, very, very important concept, and we're going to be spending some time on the theme of how do we avoid the idea of the GRAT, the client dying before the GRAT term ends. And these trusts are not GST exempt. So as we spoke earlier, if the Waltons are doing a GRAT, there's only so much that their children are going to need in life. And so the idea is to have these in trust that go multiple generations. The struggle there is that the GRAT in itself is only for the first generation, and the trust will not allow for that. We have a neat strategy, however, to sell the GRAT interest, and you'll see this on the third piece. We create a separate trust that buys the remainder interest in the GRAT. So if we had a 10-year GRAT, we in year two, we could sell the interest inside that GRAT, whatever that value is, to a separate generation skipping trust. The trust moves the assets for cash into the trust, into the GRAT, and then the GRAT transfers the GRAT interest to a generation skipping trust. And in the end here, then the GRAT and all the growth, the remainder amount of the growth, will go to the trust free of tax. So how would it work otherwise? If we had a GRAT that had $10 million and the growth on the GRAT went from 10 to 11, that $1 million would not be generation skipping tax free because of the way that the structure of the GRAT works. However, if we were to have a separate trust buy the remainder interest in the first couple of years of the GRAT, and move that into its own generation skipping trust, and paid the GRAT $1 million of assets, or had a loan structure set up, at the end of the GRAT term, the trust owes $1 million, but the growth on that GRAT went tax-free generation skip into a generation skipping trust for the benefit of not just the children in the Walton family, but grandchildren and great-grandchildren. We talk about them because it's moving billions, but this same strategy is still incredibly relevant for someone who's moving $5 or $10 million off their balance sheet as well. But again, without that sale of the remainder interest to a generation skipping trust, every grad, and by the way, to be clear, the overwhelming majority of grads are non-GST. The growth just lands in the children's names, and the celebration is, hey, we got past one round of estate tax. We've escaped the angel of death on that. We'll redo grant work for the children, and they can do them to their grandchildren. So these are the three reasons why you would not, why you may hesitate. Let's go back to one, which says the assets have to outperform the 75-20 rate. We, like so many others, found ourselves in a situation where clients in 2007, 8, 9, and 10 found themselves with grants that were underperforming. And so at the end of the grant term, what happens is the last piece is not made because each year you have your annuity payment, there wasn't enough money. The grant simply just folds and the payment can't be made. But for those people who were savvy in the markets, they said, look, we're at historic lows right now. Redo a new grant for me right away. And in fact, by 2011 and 12, they had doubled the money that was inside the grant. And so all of that growth was off of their balance sheet. And we saw $1, $3, $5, $10 million of growth in grants during that period by 2010, 11, and 12 when the markets started to climb out of the hole. So the essential piece here is it may not perform in 1 year, but you have to encourage your clients to have a long horizon with doing these grants. We're on slide 9. So a single grad retains the right to receive the annual payment for a fixed period of time. That's what we've been discussing up to now. So, however, if you die before the grad term ends, the IRS says the transfer never effectively took place. The transfer only takes place at the end of the grad. So what mistake have we made here is if we die in year 9 of a 10-year grant and say it's a $10 million grant and there is a, let's call it a $2 million growth, that $2 million would have passed tax-free if the client lived to year 10, but since the client didn't, then the strategy behind that is the $2 million of tax planning evaporated. So how do you get around that? Well, our clients have often said when we recommended this idea to move forward with it, and we think you should consider it, which is to do shorter grants. And so rather than 10-year grants, where you capture 10 years of growth, do a two to three-year grant. The purpose of that grant is to say, I've got $10 million in here, and in the next 3 years, I'm going to get paid back $3-plus million per year as part of the annuity payments plus my interest. And each of those grants, we're now in a situation where each of those annuity payments will create a new grant. So in year one, we have a $3 million payment back to us. We'll create a 3-year grant with that, which would then have a 3-year period. And in year one of that $3 million grant, we'll have a $1 million annuity payment. In year two of the $10 million grant, which is moving along on a parallel path, we'll have a $3 million annuity payment back. So the client will then have $4 million. And so by year three, the client will have annuity payments from two grants. And then we'll create the third grant, which would be a 3-year grant on that one and with $4 million. And, of course, $1.3 million will come back from that. And each of these will have a rolling annuity. But then the first grant will be done in 3 years. The second grant will be done in 4 years. The third grant will be done in 5 years. And you'll keep doing this. And the purpose for this is that you're still getting the same growth out over a 10-year period, but if you die in year three, then at least you got, or year four, at least you got the first grad growth out of your estate and you didn't blow the grad in total. So the rolling grads have been a strategy that have been employed for years. It is why President Obama said I tried to get approvals for only 10-year grads and above to discourage people from doing the short-term rolling grads, number one. The second issue on why short-term rolling grads present a tiny concern but not dispositive is that the grat is based on the current market interest that the government sets up on the 75-20 scales. And so in that, if rates climb, then every year you're doing your new grat, you're at the new rate of interest. Today, the economists continue to talk about a low inflation and therefore low interest rate environment, so we're not so concerned about it. But when President Obama was in office, as a more conservative approach, we did short-term rolling grats to capture the interest, to capture the growth, and also to hedge against premature death, mortality risk. But we also did a side-by-side midterm grat, which was 7-8 years long, would not have been subject to the Obama imposition of tax. He never got the bill passed. And so at least if rates climbed or Obama changed the rule and got through a 10-year minimum grad, we had a much longer grad, and hopefully you outlived that. So it was hedging. And a lot of grad planning is hedging, because the idea being that you can die, that interest rates can come up, that portfolios may not perform. But by hedging, you're capturing the growth wherever you can. Staggered grats are the ideas of which we've just spoke about now, having the rolling grats for a few years and then coupling it with a midterm grat, which would be 7 to 9 years. It is important that you are chasing yield. And so if you were to have multiple investments, the idea is to choose one or two that you think have the highest likelihood of performing, because the last thing you want to do is watch the two positions you have explode up and then two others retreat and then you get a muted return. Because in the end, it's only the growth that makes these grats sing and hum along. So we've often told clients to diversify the grats. And that means that you would take three or four different stock positions and put one in each grat. And let's say two performed and two didn't. Well, those individual positions that performed, all the growth would be off your balance sheet. The ones that underperformed, then just whatever is remaining in the grat, even if the payments can't be made at the end of the grat term, whatever is remaining drops back into your name. And there's no harm, no foul, but the growth on the high flyers is preserved off your balance sheet, and it's why we like the idea of diversifying. We have to be respectful, however, and all those of you listening, that clients are always focused on alpha and yield on their investments, but they're part of the yield has to do with what the opportunity costs are. So are they prepared to do three or four grats in one sitting with three or four stock positions, because they love each of them? And it's a rare client that has three or four individual positions that believes each of them is going to skyrocket. The one thing you need to take away, though, is that what we don't want is a muted return. So it's our recommendation that if your clients only choose baskets of stocks, then the most aggressive portion of their portfolio should be the piece that they invest in the grad, because you're chasing yield. If it doesn't work, then you'll catch it on the next grad, the new structure that you have, like clients of ours did in 2007, 8, and 9. But if it does work, that's where the growth is. So it's all offense, not to be worried about the defense. When do we worry about defense? Defense comes when we're focusing on immunization. So let's just say we do a midterm grad of 7 years, and the stock we're expecting is going to be the company stock, and the company is going to be sold in 5 to 7 years. And so we're waiting, and bingo, in 18 months after the stock was put into the grad, the company gets sold, and or the stock explodes up, and now the client says, well, I've gotten all the yield. Can we break the grad? And the answer is absolutely not. You have to live through the term of the grad, and at the end, then whatever growth is there is there. What we have had our clients smartly do, we think, is that when that position has matured and they've maximized the return, they immunize the grad, which is the fourth, fifth piece of the on the bullets on types of grads, page 9. Through the immunization, they'll go to cash, or they'll put in a bond portfolio. They're no longer chasing the yields, because the last thing you want to do is be up 50% in the first 3, 4, or 5 years on a longer term grad, and then wind up being down that equal amount. Look, Lord knows we've learned, you know, in the period from 2000 to 2010, there was no growth. But imagine if clients had a real run through 2005, went to cash and immunized, and then rolled through the end of the grad term and had preserved the growth. Some of this requires prescient knowledge and genius in investing. And the best investors make estate planners look more like geniuses than maybe they deserve to be. But our job is to remind the clients that there are vehicles and tools to allow them to do that kind of strategy. Be mindful that there are more to come in this discussion, but it's with flexibility that we can preserve the growth that takes place early on through the immunization. We are on to slide 10. Grad escalating annuity payments, right? So the first piece always is the following. If I do a grad, and we'll work with whatever periods you want, but let's work with a midterm grad amount. We can do, again, long-term, short-term, which are the ones that protect against mortality risk, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, and midterms, which protect against legislation and against mortality and interest rates. Let's just say we work with a 7-year grad, right? So in that, the 7-year period, we used Ben as an example earlier on. He's got a 5-year payment back, and we had set the fixed fee. So the good news here is you're paying back a non-inflationary number in the form of interest and a very low amount and the principal payment while you're enjoying an inflationary asset that's coming to you. You being the trust and the trustee, which is exactly what the client wants to hear. Now, what if we could stagger the payments instead of having them fixed at $300,000 per year and instead set up a schedule where in each year, and it's actually an algebraic calculation that we'll work through, which will in the end say that in the first year, we'll have the lowest payment. In the second year, we'll have a higher payment. The last year of the grad will have the highest payment because you now have to catch up. The amount that you can do that cannot exceed 120% from the prior grad amount. So that if you have a 10-year grad with $1 million in it, then each of those 10 years, the delta between the prior year and the ensuing year can only be 120%. But when you're working with that escalation, you now know that you're saving more inside the trust, less is going out, and more being in the trust is now in a position to enjoy the appreciation. So we would encourage you when you're speaking with your practitioners that you're working with, or if you're doing this yourself, be mindful that you have that escalation opportunity, but only up to 120%. The other piece to be mindful of is that there is a anniversary where the payment has to be made, but there is a grace period. And so many of our clients like the idea that we'll go into the grace period, and it can be up to a couple of months, so there's further growth that could take place. Maybe it's in a year when you're expecting the stock or the portfolio to pop, or it went down for a period and you're hoping to see it recover. If you manage your grads appropriately and adroitly, that extra 60 days before the payment is made could have really material impact on the yield that the grad is ultimately going to receive. And then last, if it's expected, so we would address this in bullet three, you'll make this decision up front, and then the schedule of payments will follow thereafter. You cannot do it later in the term of the trust. You have it done up front. Okay. So we talked about this before. We're on slide 11 of 42. Again, because the GRAT is not a GST-exempt entity, it is important to establish that while the overwhelming majority of GRATs do not address and consider the generation skipping tax piece, we will virtually all the time not only address it but employ it depending on how much growth we're anticipating on the back side of this and how much net worth the children have. So if the children are already in estate tax land themselves or anticipate because they're high earners and they're getting support from their parents that their net worth is growing, then we do not want $1 million to land in trust for the benefit of the children, and then the children now have their own estate tax issues. So the idea is that a trust, which is generation skipping tax exempt, buys the remainder interest, which is yet to be established because we don't know if there's going to be any with the grant. It all depends on the portfolio performance over the period of years. And because of that uncertainty, the generation skipping trust, tax-free trust, can buy the remainder interest at a remarkably low price because of the uncertainty as to what it's going to get. It's a lottery ticket. And then the trust then owns that remainder interest. Okay. We are now on, which is generation skipping tax free. We are on, page 12 of 42. So bailout on a failing grad. What happens if you're in a 7-year grad and the stock is poorly performing? So if the grantor originally believed that the position was going to explode, but the liquidity event did not come as expected to occur during the original term of the grant, and they're confident that this is not going to happen, we now know that we have an underperforming or non-performing grant. We can purchase out that interest, which is different from the remainder interest. We're purchasing, which is what you do for a generation skipping trust. Here you're purchasing the actual principal out of the trust for whatever that amount is, okay, at the depreciated value. So say we put in $1 million and it was down to $500,000 and the grant term is going to the growth will not take place until after the grant ends. So during that period of time, what we are then enjoying is the opportunity to then buy that underperforming piece and then roll it into a new trust so that then we can do a longer-term grant and capture the growth whenever it takes place from that point going forward. And this is a critical piece. So you're, in effect, resetting the grant to more closely match when that stock performance is going to take place. And we've had some clients really take good advantage of that when the stock originally underperformed. Okay, next is the charitable lead trust. We're on page, again, 13 of 42. The strategy here says I have an appreciated asset. There are two ways to look at this. Number one, I have appreciated asset that has gone from let's just say $1 million to $10 million for easy math. And with that appreciated asset, if I sell it, I know that I'm going to be paying plus 30% in the New York metropolitan area and certainly other places on the West Coast where we have clients in California and all the way up the West Coast, as well as certain central states where there's an income tax. That situation is 30% off of $10 million, is a significant haircut. So clients look at this and say, what can I do to maximize the amount of the asset that I will not be subject to the tax? And so they'll create a trust, which will be for charity. And part one is the asset goes into the trust. The asset can then be sold because it's a charitable trust, and there will be no income tax on that. Then at that time, there will be an annuity payment from the trust on an annual basis that will go into the charity that the client chooses. Our recommendation is that you choose your own family foundation. We are huge fans of that particular strategy here, because now the foundation is the receptacle of the annuity payment from the charitable lead trust, and you and your spouse and or your loved ones, and certainly if you have children or grandchildren, can all be on that foundation, so the family all benefits. And then from that foundation, you'll have to make a minimum of 5% withdrawals on an annual basis. The New York Times has been focusing on these charities because people have been looking for opportunities to help those with natural disasters suffering, whether it's Puerto Rico or the west coast of Florida or Texas or Northern California, or even these tragedies we've had in the church in Texas or in New York City. And so they're using their foundations as ways to make these charitable gifts. In fact, there's a good article in the New York Times on Monday about how to invest in your foundations when you're looking for small, unique opportunities. This firm was quoted, and its client was the one that was chosen to highlight gifts being made to Puerto Rico. So the charitable lead trust would be the funder of the asset, the annuity stream, to the foundation. The amount that has to go on an annual basis is based on the size of the gift that is gone into the trust and what the estate tax would otherwise, the income tax would otherwise be. So as you look at bullet number two, a fixed amount or percentage of trust assets are paid to the charity pursuant to the rate of return. Now, at the end of the established annuity payments to the charitable, to the foundation inside the charitable lead trust, those assets then, what is remaining, will go to, for the benefit of the loved ones that you've created. So, like with a grad, annuity payments go, but here to the foundation as opposed to the grant, the annuity payments come back to you. The annuity payments go to the foundation, your family controls it, and whatever growth takes place at the end goes to your loved ones without any transfer tax. It is a phenomenal strategy, and again, takes advantage of a time now where grants, the annuity payments, is based not just on the tax that's due, but also on the rate of interest for how many years it's going to take to pay off that due tax. So we see clients doing these charitable lead trusts when they have an appreciated position, maybe in one or two stocks or in a company interest, where they're charitably inclined and they want and they love the idea of a foundation where they know that not all of it's going to the foundation, where they love tax planning as well, and so they're seeing the great tax benefit. I think the last piece to emphasize here is that we have clients doing charitable lead trusts in their wills. So it's not unusual for a client to say, McManus, I've used all of my exemptions. I've sold all my real estate and my other assets to my kids, but there's a note due back to me. So on my death, there is a $50 million tax. What can I do about that tax? Because my children are going to have to pay that, and they've got all these illiquid investments. So the answer is, well, on your death, leave the notes that are due back to you from the sale of assets into trust. Leave whatever remaining assets you've kept in your name to live from for the remainder of your life somewhere. You know, depending on quality of life, some clients are leaving 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 million in their names, and they live off of that. So that plus any notes that are due back to them from assets they've sold to the children will leave into a charitable lead trust. The trust will fund the foundation for the family, and then after that annuity period is done with and we've effectively paid to the charity the amount necessary to zero out the estate tax, then at that point, the remainder goes to the children and grandchildren, and that can be in a generation-skipping trust. We don't have any limitations like we did with a grad. And in the end here, you've given the children, maybe in the end, a far greater amount than they would have received if the estate tax had taken 50% away and forced the illiquid, inordinate, inopportune time to remove these assets, but allow them to continue to grow because they remain rather inside the charitable lead trust. We think it's a wonderful strategy for clients who are focused on charity, but also on minimizing estate tax and debt. So here's one more simple example. Ben gives $3 million to a charitable lead trust with a 20-year term, paying fixed and annual payments of $187,000 per year to the charity. The amount of taxable gift is zero. The IRS rate is 2.2% in our example. The actual rate of return on the portfolio is 5%. And so in the end here, we have $2,795,275 left for after the 20-year term to pass to beneficiaries. So he starts with $3 million. He would have paid 50% tax on that in our scenario because he's already used his exemption, and he can't sell any other assets at this point. And so there'd be $1.5 million in tax. That portfolio has shrunk by $1.5 million and then can only hope to grow going forward. But in the meantime, if he used the charitable lead trust, he would have almost $3 million passing to his beneficiary. It's after a significant period of time, but he would also have a foundation that is funded that both children and grandchildren would be able to benefit from. We are on to the next slide. Advantages and disadvantages. Again, if the grantor does not need the income stream, the grantor can transfer the appreciation. This is while alive, appreciation outside of his estate, right? And he can do this also when he passes away, to provide an income stream to the charity of his or her choosing, and to provide advantages with a lump sum of growth free of estate and or gift tax. The disadvantages is if the assets do not outperform the IRS rate, then the beneficiaries could get little to nothing because the annuities remain fixed each year. You could also do a charitable lead trust with what they call a shark fin, and to allow for a certain spike over the course of the payment and providing for a greater opportunity for assets to pass to the children while still meeting the IRS's requirement for the proper annuity payment on an annual basis over that period of years. Under any circumstances, though, what you're passing to the children, to the foundation, will remain unchanged. So these strategies, of course, are not advantageous if the grantor needs access to an income stream because the annuities do not come back to the grantor. In that instance, the grantor would not choose a charitable lead trust. There are things like charitable remainder trusts, where the grantor can, in fact, take advantage of an annuity stream back to themselves, and the remainder goes to the charity. But with the markets performing well and interest rates low, having the annuity be fixed before the lead trust is started and the tax that's due, and getting that annuity done sooner and quicker rather than later, gives the highest performance to the end users, not the grantor in that instance. It would be children and grandchildren, but the lead trusts are the strategy of preference provided the grantor does not need the assets during their lifetime, or when they pass away, the grantor understands the whole value of transferring assets to the charitable lead trust. Okay, we're on 16. Installment sale to an intentionally defective trust. We spoke about this earlier today, where assets are gifted to an intentionally defective grantor or trust or an IDGET. They're completed gifts. They're outside the grantor's estate. The grantor continues to be characterized as the owner for income tax purposes and pays the income tax on trust earnings. So I move $5 million into a trust. I retain the right to swap trustees. I retain the right to borrow from the trust. I retain the right to swap assets within the trust. And all of those items, the IRS says, hey, McManus, your client still can say these assets are off their balance sheet, but we're going to make you pick up the income tax. And the IRS believed that that was the kind of punitive action that would discourage people. But the sophisticated estate planner said this is a home run. So now you move $5 million into trust. It grows to $6 million. There is a $300,000 tax due on that gain over the past 12 months. Rather than the trust suffering tax drag and paying it, you pay the tax. So in the end, you continue to reduce your estate on your balance sheet, and you're watching assets grow in trust off your balance sheet. It is one of the most elementary strategies that our clients do, and the one that is most consistently and effectively deployed. The remainder interest, for example, in the GRAP would go into a defective grantor trust. The remainder interest that comes in from the charitable lead trust would go into a defective grantor trust. Any trust we recommend would have the income being picked up by the grantor. The grantor can shut that spigot off. Or if the grantor is married, the grantor can allow its spouse to be a distributee. So in any given year, if the taxes are too high, they'll make a distribution to the spouse who, filing jointly with the grantor, can use that cash to pay the tax from the trust. So there's a $1 million gain in the given year, $300,000 worth of tax. Grantor doesn't want to pay the tax in that given year, even though there's plenty of assets. He or she's got their own liquidity issues. They take the profits. They distribute out $300,000. Grantor blends it in with their own account. They have the liquidity payment, the liquidity amount necessary to make the tax payment. Okay. Excuse me one sec. Okay, thanks. All right. So we're now down to how does this work when the grantor wants to sell assets in his family to the defective grantor trust? How does the grantor sell these assets? So first issue here is the grantor can sell assets to this trust, number one, but the trust has to have assets inside of it to satisfy the IRS's concern that this is a legitimate bona fide transaction, that the trust is funded and has legitimate assets. So in that instance, the IRS accepts that we have seed money of roughly 10%. So if we're dealing with a grantor trust that's buying $10 million of assets from the client, from the grantor, then $1 million of funding should go into the trust. Now the trust is fully funded for the IRS's standpoint to make it look, smell, and feel like a legitimate business entity. And then it can go ahead and buy $10 million of partnership assets from the Generation 1 wealthy grandparent, for this instance. At that point, the transfer takes place, and a note would be issued by the trust, signed, to be made payable to the grantor, and that would be paid over the years going forward. So number one is fund the trust. Number two, create a note. Number three is you're going to sell assets to the trust at a discount. So maybe that is an apartment building. Maybe it's a fractional interest in the apartment building, and when you do that, you're able to get a discount because it's non-controlling and illiquid. Number three, you're selling an interest to the child that is appreciating quickly so that they have some liquidity. But in any of those instances, on an annual basis, the payment has to be made back to the grantor. Now, to the extent there is growth and realized gain inside the trust, the grantor pays the tax. And so now that growth continues to grow without any tax drag inside the trust. Number two, if the grantor dies before the note is paid off, the sale to the trust is not blown up. The sale continues to work. What happens is the trust owes the unpaid note to the estate. And so at that point, the estate then would continue to receive the payments. It would not trigger necessarily an acceleration of the payment because if the borrower passes away, if the lender passes away, it's different than if the borrower passes away and your credit risk has changed, and that's why there's an acceleration. Under this instance, the borrower should continue to be able to make those payments. So the note would be due. But what you're seeing here is that it's a fixed inflation-free amount to the going back to the grantor, but the beneficiary trust is getting the inflated assets in their name. So the apartment building could go from $10 to $20 million in the period of time that the sale transaction takes place with a note financing. Or even more simply, a $10 million apartment building that's in a partnership and you sell the limited units to the children, maybe you get a 30% discount with proper drafting of your partnership documents, and you get an appraisal from an independent appraising company or even certain accounting firms. Those of you on the phone may be doing that kind of work, where you would attach the appraisal to the back of the gift tax return. At that point, the building is sold for $7 million, but it's worth $10. And then over a five-year period, the note is down to $5 million, and the building has appreciated from $10 to $14 million. So in the end, the trust paid $7, the building is worth $14, the note that's outstanding to grandpa and grandma is five, so in the end, your delta or your growth is $9 million. Along the way, income from the building, the tax is being paid by grandpa, so the cash is building up inside the trust to the extent that it's not being used to pay the note off. But it is a phenomenal strategy, and if grandpa dies before the note ends, it still works. What you do have to be careful of is that if grandpa does this strategy and then dies within a year, sometimes the IRS can audit this and look at this as a, you know, near deathbed transaction and maybe look to overrun it. All right, we're on to page 17. So Ben owns a brokerage account with $30 million with an annual 7% growth rate, resulting in $2 million in return. As Ben is already above the federal exemption amount, the more the brokerage account grows, the more the estate tax he will have to pay. Ben does not want to gift the account, whether in whole or apart, as doing so will exhaust his exemption, or it may have already been exhausted. So Ben calls, sets up the brokerage account, opens up the IGIT in exchange for a promissory note. 2% is the rate of interest for the next 20 years, with a balloon payment due at the end. The trust pays Ben $600,000 per year in interest on the $30 million account, but since the trust is making 7% annually, or $2.1 million, then the net delta is $1.5 million in growth per year. This is growing inside the trust is not paying the tax. The grantor is paying the tax, not the trust, so no tax drag takes place there. So on a compounded basis, by smoothing out the 7% returns, the net benefit would be 20 years at $1.5 million or $35 million, plus the original 30 that was transferred into the trust. The compounding effect of the sale to the trust is significant. This does not include what happens if you could sell this portfolio to the trust at a discount. With stock, it is not as easy to do. The IRS does not allow that because these are liquid accounts. With real estate and other private businesses, the discounts would only serve to amplify the return. To the extent that the assets are sold inside the trust, of course, the gains tax is paid. We're on to page 19. So the advantages are the sale does not use much of the grantor's exemption, although an initial seed contribution, of course, has to be made of 10%. Sometimes people just loan the trust $1 million rather than make a gift, which enables them to have to not use liquidity. In other instances, they'll use partnership assets, which they can discount or not discount in that instance, and get more value into the trust. Again, this is a 10% seed. It does allow one to lock in the value of the asset, and the grantor, Generation 1, is happy because they're still receiving the income stream. The disadvantages is there's a cost to set up. So to do the partnership, to wrap the assets, to create the grantor trust, to do the note work, to get appraisals from an independent appraising company, to file a gift tax return. You know, this kind of work can range from $10,000 to $50,000, depending on the level of sophistication. And certainly the big firms, I come from two of the biggest firms in the world, it would be more likely that those firms would charge $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. But they'll emphasize, as I want to emphasize, it is the alpha that we're gaining for the client. Even with a single-digit rate of return over the 20-year period, we're talking millions and millions of dollars. So putting the structure in place is a fixed cost indeed, but the return on the investment is where the emphasis has to lie. So, but if the asset performs poorly and the grantor dies before the promissory note, a significant portion of the original sale would be taxed as part of the grantor's estate. That would be no different, however, if the grantor never transferred the assets. We're on to page 21. The IGIT is a pass-through tax-free entity. We've talked about this piece because if it's defective, the income tax is paid by the grantor until they either terminate the special provisions of replacing assets, ability to remove trustees, borrowing from the trust, which are provisions that make it defective, or that they just decide no longer they want to pay the tax. But we feel as long as possible, pay the tax, even if you have to name your spouse as a discretionary beneficiary. Never give up that opportunity. So the IGIT is a generation skipping tax-free strategy because the trust is GST-free. It is that trust that would be the one to capture the return on the grad. It's this trust that would be buying the partnership assets. It's this trust that would be doing the charitable lead trust. So this can go through multiple generations. The grads and installment sales are set at current interest rates. And the good news on that, again, is that you are dealing with, you're paying back, in effect, deflated dollars to your grantor, and your grantor has sold you, hopefully, in theory, inflating assets. So I have this line in my head. On one side, it is low, and a red line just creeps up the page to the other side. On the bottom side is what is expected back to the grantor when the sale is there for fixed rates and interest. On the other side, it is the appreciation that takes place inside the trust. We're on slide 24. Grants and installment sales, we spoke again about this. This is the discounting. And so with respect to discounting, it's critical to know that this only heightens it. If I can buy an asset for even cheaper than what we know its true value is because of what the IRS has accepted as illiquid or non-controlling assets, that discount serves us most prominently because now buying at a lower amount means every bit of growth on the original principal. So a $10 million building discounted down to 7, 7 is our investment, but when it goes to 11, we've got $4 million of growth tax-free versus $1 million. So discounts are critical. Now, 2704 regulations were where we were all racing last year because this was part two to the President Obama's strategy to say enough is enough, grants only benefit the wealthy, discounts on big values only benefit the wealthy. So rather than trying to get this passed through legislation, President Obama went straight to Treasury and had them move to pass regulations that would allow for or minimize the opportunities for families to discount assets. And family-owned businesses were the ones right in the center of that bullseye. So we did a huge amount of work before the end of last year because we were concerned that discounting was going to evaporate. If you had a $30 million business and you were selling the limited partnership units to your children, which represented 99% of the company, the appraising companies could give us a 30% discount. We were actually selling the children a company that was 10, that was worth 30 for $10 million less to $20 million. That single sale created alpha of $5 million of estate or gift tax savings, that in itself. But this is where Trump went after this and said, President Obama, and said, no go on this. Once President Trump came in, the Treasury decided to wait on comments, received many comments from lawyers and tax professionals, went and spoke on the circuit about the topic, and before they could make a decision on this, President Trump eliminated the end of the 2704 regulations and said that this will continue. What we need to know, in the same way we've talked about all tax issues, is take advantage while the getting is good. Get your discounts today on assets because President Trump will only be in office for a certain period of time, and we don't know what his successor will do. And his successor, like what's happened in New Jersey, could wind up reinstating all of these pieces. All right, we're on to slide 26. The intentionally defective grantor trust sale of its business interest. So when the value is modest, so the growth takes place outside the estate, we have certain advantages. When we sell a business that allows for valuation discounts, we get further advantages. When the installment sale in exchange for a promissory note allows the client to receive the revenue from the business, so I sell my company to my children, they pay me back, but I'm getting the income stream. Okay, and then last is that the clients covered the opportunity to maintain the annual stream of payments from the trust to preserve their cash flow, particularly after the trust is sold. So we don't need to go through this example again, but on the bottom bullet here, just be mindful that Ben can sell the business to the trust in exchange for the note. The payments can be made 2% per year for the 15 years with a balloon payment at the end, or he could have a much higher payment schedule because he wants to get paid back sooner and he wants to preserve his income. The sliding scale for how much the business owner wants back is purely up to the business owner. And it's important as you as a professional that you make it clear that they'll still enjoy their quality of life. It would not be the first or the 100th time that we've been with clients that say, I love my income. I'm making $25,000, $100,000 a month, $200,000 a month. The last thing I want to do is sell my business to my kids and then they get it. Well, the answer is you're selling it and then the note will come back. How much do you want on a monthly basis? I want it all. That's okay, too, because at least what we've done is we've sold the asset at a discount. We've frozen its growth off your balance sheet, but you still are enjoying the income stream. Okay, we can continue with this example, but just to be clear on the last piece, for instance, at the end of the first year, the business appreciated at $21 million by getting a big new customer, plus the generated profits of $1.5 million, and then paid out the $400,000 of interest, it would be up to $22.1 million. By contrast, the grantor's estate would still be $20 million plus interest of $400K, but reduced by the income tax liabilities it has to pay. So again, all of this growth, if the grantor is surely well-heeled, the growth is taking place in the company, and the grantor is paying the tax liability. So at the end of this, we're looking at $800,000 in estate tax savings just in the first year, not including the discount that the grantor and the beneficiaries of the trust had. This is just in the return on the investment inside the trust. So always having the spouse have the ability to access the trust. Remember, the grantor cannot, but if the spouse does, it puts us in a far better position for us to always be able to make a distribution at. We were with clients earlier today, and they said, look, you know, we're moving all our money out of our estate. We'll give us some for ourselves. And we always laugh when we hear this when these clients bring this up, because they're right. And in the end, look who's built it, look who's managed it, and yes, they want to avoid the tax. This is not about unduly enriching your children and grandchildren who you may not feel have earned the right to receive it or will appreciate what you've done. What we're saying is that the alternative may be a social program, the world's largest in the form of the U.S. government, may not be exactly what you want to do with your money. So this strategy just says leave it in a multi-generation trust that can start for years. Some states have limitations on how far you can go. New York does. New Jersey doesn't. Florida doesn't. California doesn't. Some of the best states for these kinds of planning are in Delaware, South Dakota, Nevada, and Alaska, where we'll set up trusts that could go on for a long time and their asset protected. But put it in a trust where distributions, you can advise the trustee, are not made for the next 50 years. But the alternative is that that the IRS will get this amount. So removing the trustee we spoke about, this is how we ensure that the trust will be defective because the grantor is retaining rights. You also want to have inside the trust a decanting provision. What is decanting? It's like decanting a bottle of wine. You open the top, you pour it into a new glass vessel, which we call a decanter. Not a speck of it touches the ground, and therefore the new vessel holding this asset, the IRS accepts, is still the valid trust from the first trust. Some states statutorily allow for decanting. New York does in this instance. Delaware does. South Dakota does. But places like New Jersey and Connecticut and other states in the South and have not specifically allowed for decanting. And so in those, we often will move the trust to one of those states that we've just spoken about and decant the trust in that state, allowing additional beneficiaries, allowing the spouse to be a beneficiary, creating a trust that could go through multiple generations that otherwise wasn't. So decanting provisions should be in every trust, even a brand new one today, because we don't know what could happen 10, 15, 20 years from now. All right, we're on slide 31. So what happens if we can't make the annual payment? Well, the same way it couldn't be if you're in some kind of structure for another business interest. You'd go back to the lender, which is your grantor, and you'd restructure it. You'd perform. You'd have interest accrue but remain unpaid. And then hopefully the monetization event happens inside the trust and more growth goes to the kids and to loved ones. So you can always restructure it. We're often big fans, we're on to slide 32, of allowing insurance as a hedging factor. So if you're doing a grant or even a sale to a defective trust, the assets have not fully moved out of the estate, or maybe not at all, if the client dies before the term ends. So having insurance, we're huge fans of insurance. We think every high quality estate plan has insurance in it, either as an investment because of the compounding that can take place tax-free inside the trust, because of the asset protection of the life insurance, because of the hedging that it allows if the client dies too soon, or just for the liquidity to pay the estate tax at the end, which has always been a leading indicator for many estate planners. But insurance should often be considered specifically and surgically for when you do grafts or sales to trust, because if you die before the term ends, with a graft, you blow it up. With a sale to a trust, you have unpaid notes that would be included in the estate, and estate tax would be due on that. We're on to slide 33. The partnership freeze strategies. So this strategy is, through this strategy, we recommend it's for older and higher net worth clients who can shift the growth of the assets to the next generation, but they're never losing the income to live on. So the client creates a new LLC, transfers the assets into the partnership in exchange for a preferred interest, preferred meaning a return above the remainder investors inside the partnership or the LLC. The preferred interest value is frozen, and that return is the payout is what we in a preferred fixed return. It's similar to a bond. So this is the guaranteed amount you want. And this gives the client the comfort to say, we're going to give this to you every year. The client receives a liquidation preference, entitling the client to a priority return on his or her capital contribution upon liquidation of the partnership. So at some point we may and will liquidate the partnership. The client gets their money paid back first. The client's children, or more importantly, we always have trusts. Why do all this work and have it land in the children's names or grandchildren's name individually? Even if they are the most high-quality people, the greater risks are what can happen to them by the outsiders, number one. Number two is if it's inside a trust, the growth is picked up in a grantor trust, so you're set up there and the tax is paid. And number three, this can go multiple generations without any estate tax imposed. So the children's trust would own the preferred interest. Then what we do is we're freezing the value coming back to the grantor. They get the fixed fee as the holders, and the family members get the common interest, and they take advantage of the appreciation. These things work well when the clients feel confident that their companies are going to do well. So if the growth rate exceeds the preferred rate of return, the resulting growth in the common interest is excluded from the client's estate and inures to the benefit. Provided that 2701 requirements are satisfied and the client receives an adequate coupon rate for his or her qualified payment right, there are no gift tax implications. This is a moderately new strategy, but a very, very effective one, and the initial capital contribution is considered the retained interest. What we put into the preferred partnership is the interest that comes back to us. What is growth goes to the children. So Ben owns assets worth $20 million. Before Ben transfers these assets into an LLC, the initial contribution of $20 million would be frozen in the value upon the issuance of common interest to Ben's children. A fixed rate of return of 7.5% would yield $1.5 million in annual payments off the $20 million. Assuming a growth rate of 10%, every year there is a 2.5% difference, $500,000 between the fixed rate versus the actual growth. And then the growth increases the value of the common interest and is not part of the client's taxable estate. Ben now has a steady income stream from the fixed rate of return, while he also is making sure that the growth above that amount is accumulating for the benefit of the children. So there, while you have to navigate Section 2701 and be take care to read the statute to be clear about what the code says, no gift tax exemption is used. Not only does the strategy transfer asset growth to the next generation, it also ensures a stream of income to the client indefinitely. Remember, because they get the preferred rate of return on the assets. They're also the ones that have the right to liquidate. It prevents the appreciation of the assets included in the gross estate, and there is no clawback on death. If the client dies in 2 years, it does not blow up like a grat. Each of the strategies we've talked to up to now, by way of a quick segue, all of them have their values depending on liquidity, depending on the client's sophistication, depending on size of the assets. Each of them has some concerns about drawbacks, but every one of them has its advantages and disadvantages. For the partnership here, it can be viewed by the outside and unknowingly as somewhat involved and complex. Of course, it requires your help, guys, on the line, and professionals who are appraisers and attorneys. When we're dealing with the preferred interest and the rate of return, it requires interest transfers and partnership documentation. But the annual preferred coupon must be properly determined, or the client will be deemed as making a partial gift rather than a contribution and a return. So partnership freezes. Again, key things here are to avoid a deemed gift when the contribution is made to the partnership in exchange for the preferred interest that pays a fixed annual return. The preferred interest must be structured as a qualified payment. The preferred interest will be valued under traditional valuation principles. Either you guys, accountants, can do that, or there are qualified appraisers that are known nationally. So it's very important to get clear what the annual preferred coupon amount is and determine it. This is not child's play, and the appraisal is key. The retaining the interest when the structuring the rights associated with the preferred interest, it's critical that the preferred holder not retain any extraordinary payment rights. Okay, that's why you need to look at the regs to be clear about what payment rights you want. Conversion rights or rights to compel litigation, right? None of that is what we want. In the end here, the grantor has got to be in on the strategy and know what they can give and what they can't. In the end here, the grantor shouldn't be doing this if they had an overwhelming need to control. That's the same for any of these strategies. The grantor has got to be focused on, do I want to get alpha on my estate, and would I prefer that it go even for a multi-generational trust than going to the IRS? So on annual maintenance, just ensure the annuity payments are made, just like with a grad and with like interest payments on the defective trust and the annuity payments on the charitable lead trust. You must, this is work for you, but it's also compensable work. You definitely want to make sure that your clients are making those payments. You want to insulate the growth by locking in the success strategy. You want to sell positions after they have exploded in value and swap assets out and to immunize them. You want to make sure you file a gift tax return, and you must, this call is not on this, but on your returns, you must make sure that you understand generation skipping tax and check that box off. These things won't necessarily trigger a tax, but we think it's important to let the IRS know and start the statute of limitations. Nothing better. You'll hear state lawyers say old and cold when they're talking about a trust, meaning it's gone past the audit period. Do not mess with that. New planning, new trusts, which you can then blend with once the audit period is over. So on that, as we wrap up, we are on slide 42, closing questions. Just be mindful that as the estates continue to compound, the current taxing scheme permits you to get this alpha. The immediate impact can be not only upfront, but through annual returns on the money, on the business, and also in the underlying appreciation of the asset. They're great strategies for you and your clients. I'll stop there and hold for any questions that we may have in the audience.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to advise participants that the CLE code for today's program is CIRCLE, spelled C-I-R-C-L-E. Once again, the CLE code for today's program is CIRCLE, spelled C-I-R-C-L-E. We will now take questions. I'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. And there are no audio questions at this time. Mr. McManus, do you have any web questions to address?
Could you repeat that last question regarding web questions? Oh, we're looking now. Nope, we're good on questions. I want to thank Charles in our office, and Carol and Ben, who worked for hours to put the presentation together to make us sound and appear smarter than we are. So thank you for the time today, and look forward to seeing you all again on the wire.